Good afternoon. This is Walter Compton speaking from the chamber of the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. Today, both houses of the United States Congress are jointly assembled to hear the annual address by the President of the United States on the State of the Nation. Yesterday, for an hour and a half, the Mutual Network, through the facilities of WOL, brought you the impressive opening day ceremonies of the 76th Congress, a Congress which promises to be even more interesting in its activities than many a like body has been in recent years. For today, Congress is not only composed of a larger minority group than it has known since 1933, but it is also confronted with a chaotic world condition as well as problems of intense national importance. Chief among the matters to be considered by this august body this session is the question of rearmament. As you know, the President has requested a vast program of rearmament, and it is felt that his address here this afternoon will deal to a great extent with foreign affairs and the United States' attitude thereto. The gentlemen of the Congress are now gathering below, and the assemblage should be complete within the next few moments, for Mr. Roosevelt is expected to appear at 1 o'clock. This 76th Congress, ladies and gentlemen, has already had its store of shocks, for in the Senate chambers yesterday, the Campaign Expenditures Committee presented its report with reference particularly to the recent November elections. You followers of national news are aware of the contents of that report and of the charges entailed therein against various state campaigns and officials. Here in the House, Chairman Martin Dies of the House Committee Investigating Un-American Activities presented his report. These two items alone were enough to figuratively set Congress on its ear for the opening day. And what will happen after this address today is only a matter of conjecture. But with me in the balcony of the House chamber this afternoon, I hope to have Fulton Lewis, Jr., nationally known as Mutual's Washington commentator. Last year, the Mutual Network was the only national radio chain offering its listeners a complete and comprehensive analysis of the President's remarks direct from the scene of the address. It is our intention to offer that identical service again this year. While I am personally acquainted with the scene from where we speak and of the proceedings to which we listened to yesterday and will hear in modification today, Mr. Lewis is personally acquainted with many of the gentlemen on the floor at this moment. He will speak as usual with authority. Congressional sessions in their first few days are always colorful events, but many of the gentlemen below are meeting for the first time in many weeks, some for months. And all of them in the House and at least a third from the Senate have been through the ardors of political campaigning since last they met. There are anecdotes to be told, observations to be made, handshaking to be consummated, and, well, families to be introduced. These things occur during the informality before the opening gavel is struck. In addition, the newer members of Congress, many of them Republicans or anti-New Dealers, as I observed yesterday, were meeting their colleagues of the next 2 or 6 years for the first time. This scene is a little strange to them. The preponderance of talk and chatter may confuse some of them, but they'll find that after these first few days, things will quiet down considerably. Congress will put its nose to the grindstone of national legislation. Though they've probably been in these chambers before, they may still be amazed at the order that seems to result from a more or less social chaos. Youngsters who are congressional page boys dashing from seat to seat, from aisle to aisle, and in one of the adjoining sections of our balcony, newsreel cameramen, their cameras set and ready, lights glaring for the arrival of the president. And you'll see these pictures soon in your local theaters. By my side and in many spots of the balcony, newspaper photographers, their cameras trained on the scene below. And across from us in the opposite balcony, the press gallery, directly above the rostrum which we are facing and filled to the brim with national and international news representatives. For this is an important occasion. This address of the President's today is considered to be of such vital nature that not only is it coast to coast via the Mutual Network, but it is being translated into 8 languages for worldwide consumption. In the balcony here with us are many wives and friends of congressmen, both new and old, each in his own individual seat, for admission to this chamber on a day like today is by reserved ticket only. They're very difficult to get those tickets. And outside in the Capitol ground are many hundreds of persons, probably thousands of persons, who have not only come for a glimpse of the nation's greatest personality, the President of the United States, but have also come in the remote hope that they might achieve one of these seats within this chamber. The Mutual Network, incidentally, is the only national network to have its microphones, its equipment, its commentators, actually within the chamber itself. And today, ladies and gentlemen, we give you a first-hand impression of the 76th Congress of the United States. And now, for just a moment, so that you might hear this bedlam that is actually existing below, we're going to turn you over to the floor of the House of Representatives.
Thank you.
so much for the noise that exists in the chamber below on the House of Representatives floor, I'd like to point out to our listeners today who are not familiar with the scene or possibly with the tenure of office for the United States Congress that the Senate has a requirement of 30 years of age for its members, and they must have been 9 years a citizen of the United States. The House, the gentlemen of the House, must be 25 years old and must have been 7 years a citizen. Incidentally, for the first time in several years, we have one member of the House this year whose name escapes me. He's a new member who is actually just 25 years of age. He's from a congressional district in the state of Texas. In the procedure followed here in the House, insofar as bills are concerned, there are usually three readings, which I understand have been borrowed from the British parliamentary system. The first reading of a bill is a formal reading, and then it goes to committee. And naturally, with 435 members in one body, it would be very difficult to settle the contents of a bill on the floor of the House, although at times the House itself does sit as a committee of the whole, but usually most bills are rehashed and settled actually within the various committee rooms. After the first reading, as I said, the bill goes to committee, and if it has been reported favorably, it's reported back out. And on the second reading, the entire text is read once again. And then they have a debate, and with the third reading, they go into amendments. Now I see that there is some action on the floor. Speaker Bankhead has assumed the rostrum, and we take you to the floor of the House of Representatives. As is usual on an occasion when a joint session meets, the members of the United States Senate are now filing into the House of Representatives chamber. They will occupy the first two rows of seats directly before the rostrum from which the President of the United States will speak. And now Vice President Garner has ascended the rostrum and is at the top dais. The members of the House and the Senate applaud as the Vice President of the United States shakes hands very cordially with Speaker of the House, Bankhead of Alabama. Senators are still filing in, and Mr. Bankhead and Mr. Garner remain standing behind the top dais desk. There's a great deal of handshaking going on down there. After all, to get 96 gentlemen into a chamber in any minimum of time is almost impossible. They're filing down the single aisle directly beneath us. Naturally, many familiar faces are among them. I shan't attempt to enumerate because favoritism would not be exactly fair on occasion of this kind. But the entire senatorial body will be represented here today. The burst of applause which you just heard was for the single woman member of the Senate, Mrs. Hattie Carraway of Arkansas. There are 95 members this year, being all of the male gender, so to speak. The floor below us now is almost completely filled, so much so that a great many folks have even gotten on the balustrade which surrounds the floor from the wall directly behind it. They're sitting on it, and even in spots they're standing. And in addition to the regular stationary seats, which usually are in the House floor here, there have been a number of extra chairs added in the background for additional guests, because a great many congressmen take this opportunity to have their family and friends, even downstairs, actually on the floor of the House with them. Although, as I mentioned a few moments ago, a great many of them are here in the balconies with us, surrounding the floor. Now, order seems to be coming out of chaos, and I believe that in just a moment, Mr. Bankhead will sound the gavel for the gentleman to be seated.
Not yet. Everyone is standing up, patiently waiting, but no gavel as yet. The president is not to arrive for perhaps 4 minutes. And now the House seats itself, members of the Senate, and the members gathered here in this vast audience, and we radio men also.
On behalf of the House of Representatives, the chair appoints the following committee to conduct the president into the chamber. Mr. Rabin, Mr. Doughton, and Mr. Martin of Massachusetts.
I appoint the senator from Kentucky, Mr. Barkley. Senator from Nevada, Mr. Pittman. Senator from Oregon, Mr. McNair, part of the Senate. Conduct the president in the chamber.
I can, of course, point out to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the minority and majority leaders of both houses of Congress, in addition to Mr. Doughton, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, and even now, in the excitement of the moment, I have forgotten the other senator, the senator's name who was coming in. Who was that, John? Do you remember? Mr. Doughton of the House Ways and Means and the Senate, the additional senator. I beg your pardon. Well, I have him, but I'm thinking of in terms of the third senator. Well, I'm sure the audience heard him. I was going, oh, yes, Mr. Pittman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Senate. Those gentlemen are now filing out the door to greet the president. The president comes in directly opposite us, ascending the left-hand side of the rostrum as we face it. There's not so much talk now as there was just a moment ago, because the big moment of today is just about to arrive. Even now, I imagine, the car bearing the President of the United States and his escort has driven up to the Capitol outside in the grounds. Possibly those hundreds of people who were waiting out there to see him are even seeing him at the present moment. Mr. Garner and Mr. Bankhead are seated themselves quite naturally and are talking. Down on the floor, various members of Congress are chatting rather easily, but not too vociferously as time passes on. On these occasions, this is really the only time in the year that the floor of the House is actually full to capacity. Naturally, the balconies here are quite frequently filled when some bill of merit turns up. We livers here in Washington and also visitors to the Capitol make every effort to come in, and on those days, it isn't necessary to have a ticket to enter, as it is today, because if the tickets weren't being issued, why, it would be almost literally impossible to get a seat here. The way the House of Representatives is chosen, you know, ladies and gentlemen, or rather the entire Congress, there must be 2 members of the Congress from each state of the Union, total of 96 in all, and there is one representative elected for each 211,877 population in the state. But the law does say that every state, if it doesn't have the quota of representation, must have at least one representative. There are 5 states with but one representative here. Those states are Arizona, Delaware, Nevada, New Mexico, and Wyoming. Although the House usually has 435 members, there are but 434 today. I return you down to the House. Ladies and gentlemen, the applause is for the arrival of the President's Cabinet, led by the new Attorney General, Mr. Murphy, Mr. Farley, Mr. Woodring, Mr. Harry Hopkins, the new Commerce Secretary, Mrs. Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, the various other members of the Cabinet, Mr. Wallace. They are now seating themselves in a group of impromptu chairs, even before the Senate itself. Chair specially placed every year this time for the cabinet officers. This, incidentally, is the first time that either Mr. Hopkins, who was formerly, as you know, WPA administrator and is now Secretary of Commerce, or Mr. Murphy, who is now the Attorney General, have attended any session of Congress in their official capacities as members of the President's Cabinet. Now, the doors have opened for the President's entrance. though I don't believe he himself is actually coming yet, I see some gentleman moving down the hallway, possibly either to clear the corridor or else to enter just before him. Now I see Mr. Roosevelt coming down the corridor without the chamber, and he is resting on someone's arm, but I cannot see as yet who it is. Usually, he rests, you know, on his son James's arm. I have not seen the elder Roosevelt's son yet, but possibly he is there. Now the assembly arises for the entrance of the president. He's being preceded, of course, by the committee which was chosen to escort him in. Mr. Sam Rayburn, the minority leader of the House, the majority leader of the House, has ascended the rostrum first. Down from the stand. Mr. Pittman comes down. Mr. Rayburn has now come down. Mr. Martin of Massachusetts, the newly elected minority leader of the House, has stepped down. Now the president steps up to his desk. Lest you interrupt any further, we transfer you now permanently to the floor of the House of Representatives.
Senators and representatives of the 76th Congress, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 76th Congress, in reporting on the state of the nation, I have felt it necessary on previous occasions to advise the Congress of disturbance abroad and of the need of putting our own house in order in the face of storm signals from across the seas. As this 76th Congress opens, there is need for further warning. A war which threatened to envelop the world in flames has been averted. But it has become increasingly clear that world peace is not assured. All about us rage undeclared wars, military and economic. All about us grow more deadly armaments, military and economic. All about us are threats of new aggressions, military and economic. Storms from abroad directly challenge three institutions indispensable to Americans, now as always. The first is religion. Religion is the source of the other two, democracy and international good faith. Religion, by teaching man his relationship to God, gives the individual a sense of his own dignity and teaches him to respect himself by respecting his neighbors. Democracy, the practice of self-government, is a covenant among free men to respect the rights and liberties of their fellows. International good faith, a sister of democracy, springs from the will of civilized nations of men to respect the rights and the liberties of other nations of men. In a modern civilization, all three, religion, democracy, and international good faith complement and support each other. Where freedom of religion has been attacked, the attack has come from sources opposed to democracy. Where democracy has been overthrown, the spirit of free worship has disappeared. And where religion and democracy have vanished, good faith and reason in international affairs have given way to strident ambition and brute force. An ordering of society which relegates religion, democracy, and good faith among nations to the background can find no place within it for the ideals of the Prince of Peace. The United States rejects such an ordering and retains its ancient faith. There comes a time in the affairs of men when they must prepare to defend not their homes alone, but the tenets of faith and humanity on which their churches, their governments, and their very foundations are set. The defense of religion, of democracy, and of good faith among nations is all the same fight. To save one, we must now make up our minds to save all. And we know what might happen to us of the United States if the new philosophies of force were to encompass the other continents and invade our own. We, no more than other nations, can afford to be surrounded by the enemies of our faith and our humanity. Fortunate it is, therefore, that in this Western Hemisphere, we have under a common ideal of democratic government a rich diversity of resources and of peoples functioning together in mutual respect and peace. That hemisphere, that peace, and that ideal we propose to do our share in protecting against storms from any quarter. Our people and our resources are pledged to secure that protection. And from that determination, no American flinches. This by no means implies that the American republics disassociate themselves from the nations of other continents. It does not mean the Americas against the rest of the world. We, as one of the republics, reiterate our willingness to help the cause of world peace. We stand on our long historic offer to take counsel with all other nations of the world to the end that aggression among them may be terminated, that the race of armaments cease, and that commerce be renewed. But the world has grown so small and weapons of attack so swift that no nation can be safe in its will to peace so long as any other powerful nation refuses to settle its grievances at the council table. For if any government bristling with implements of war insists on policies of force, weapons of defense give the only safety. In our foreign relations, we have learned from the past what not to do. From new wars, we have learned what we must do. We have learned that effective timing of defense and the distant points from which attacks may be launched are completely different from what they were 20 years ago. We have learned that survival cannot be guaranteed by arming after the attack begins, for there is new range, new speed to offense. We have learned that long before any overt military act, aggression begins with preliminaries of propaganda, subsidized penetration, the loosening of ties of goodwill, the stirring of prejudice, and the incitement to disunion. We have learned that God-fearing democracies of the world, which observe the sanctity of treaties and good faith in their dealings with other nations, cannot safely be indifferent to international lawlessness anywhere. No, they cannot forever let pass without effective protest acts of aggression against sister nations, acts which automatically undermine all of us. Obviously, they must proceed along practical, peaceful lines. But the mere fact that we rightly decline to intervene with arms to prevent acts of aggression does not mean that we must act as if there were no aggression at all. Words may be futile, but war is not the only means of commanding a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. There are many methods, short of war, but stronger and more effective than mere words, of bringing home to aggressor governments the aggregate sentiments of our own people. At the very least, we can and should avoid any action or any lack of action which will encourage, assist, or build up an aggressor. We have learned that when we deliberately try to legislate a neutrality, our neutrality laws may operate unevenly and unfairly, may actually give aid to an aggressor and deny it to the victim. The instinct of self-preservation should warn us that we ought not to let that happen anymore. And we have learned something else. The old, old lesson that probability of attack is mightily decreased by the assurance of an ever-ready defense. Since 1931, nearly 8 years ago, world events of thunderous import have moved with lightning speed. During these 8 years, many of our people clung to the hope that the innate decency of mankind would protect the unprepared who showed their innate trust in mankind. Today, we are all wiser and sadder. Under modern conditions, what we mean by adequate defense, a policy subscribed to by all of us, must be divided into three elements. First, we must have armed forces and defenses strong enough to ward off any sudden attack against strategic positions and key facilities. Essential to ensure sustained resistance and ultimate victory. Secondly, we must have the organization and the location of those key facilities so that they may be immediately utilized and rapidly expanded to meet all needs without danger of serious interruption by enemy attack. In the course of a few days, I shall send to you a special message making recommendations for those two essentials of defense against danger which we cannot safely assume will not come. If these first two essentials are reasonably provided for, we must be able confidently to invoke the third element, the underlying strength of citizenship, the self-confidence, the ability, the imagination, and the devotion that give the staying power to see things through. A strong and united nation may be destroyed if it is unprepared against sudden attack. But even a nation well armed and well organized from a strictly military point of view may, after a period of time, meet defeat if it is unnerved by self-distrust, endangered by class prejudice, by dissension between capital and labor, by false economy, and by other unsolved social problems at home. In meeting the troubles of the world, we must meet them as one people, with a unity born of the fact that for generations, those who have come to our shores, representing many kindreds and tongues, have been welded by common opportunity into a united patriotism. If another form of government can present a united front in its attack on a democracy, the attack must and will be met by a united democracy. Such a democracy can and must exist in the United States. A dictatorship may command the full strength of a regimented nation, but the united strength of a democratic nation can be mustered only when its people, educated by modern standards to know what is going on and where they are going, have conviction that they are receiving as large a share of opportunity for development, as large a share of material success and of human dignity as they have a right to receive. Our nation's program of social and economic reform is therefore a part of defense, a part as basic as armaments themselves. Against the background of events in Europe, in Africa, and in Asia, during these recent years, the pattern of what we here have accomplished since 1933 appears in even clearer focus. For the first time, we have moved upon deep-seated problems affecting our national strength and have forged national instruments adequate to meet them. Consider what the seemingly piecemeal struggles of these 6 years add up to in terms of realistic national preparedness. We are conserving and developing natural resources, land, water, power, forests. We are trying to provide necessary food, shelter, and medical care for the good, for the health of our population. We are putting agriculture, our system of food and fiber supply, on a sounder basis. We are strengthening the weakest spot in our system of industrial supply, its long smoldering labor difficulties. We have cleaned up our credit system so that depositor and investor alike may more readily and willingly make their capital available for peace or war. We are giving to our youth new opportunities for work and education. We have sustained the morale of all the population by the dignified recognition of our obligations to the aged, the helpless, and the needy. Above all, we have made the American people conscious of their interrelationship, their interdependence. They sense a common destiny and a common need of each other. Differences of occupation, geography, race, religion no longer obscure the nation's fundamental unity in thought and in action. We have our difficulties, true, but we are a wiser and a tougher nation than we were in 1929 or in 1932. Never have there been 6 years of such far-flung internal preparedness in all our history. And this has been done without any dictator's power to command, without conscription of labor or confiscation of capital, without concentration camps, and without a scratch on freedom of speech, freedom of the press, or the rest of the Bill of Rights. And I think we see things now that we could not see so well along the way. The tools of government, which we had in 1933, are outmoded. We have had to forge new tools for a new role of government operating in a democracy, a role of new responsibility for new needs and increased responsibility for old needs long neglected. Some of these tools had to be roughly shaped and still need machining down. Many of those who fought bitterly against the forging of these new tools welcome their use today. The American people as a whole have accepted them. The nation looks to the Congress to improve the new machinery which we have permanently installed, provided that in the process, the social usefulness of the machinery is not destroyed or impaired. Yes, all of us agree that we should simplify and improve laws if experience and operation clearly demonstrate the need. For instance, all of us want better provision for our older people under our Social Security legislation. For the medically needy, we must provide better care. Most of us agree that for the sake of employer and employee alike, we must find ways to end factional labor strife and employer-employee disputes. Most of us recognize that none of these tools can be put to maximum effectiveness unless the executive processes of government are revamped, reorganized, if you will, into more effective combinations. And even after such reorganization, it will take time to develop administrative personnel and experience in order to use our new tools with a minimum of mistakes. The Congress, of course, needs no further information on this. With this exception of legislation to provide greater government efficiency, and with the exception of legislation to ameliorate our railroad and other transportation problems, the past three Congresses have met in part or in whole the pressing need of the new order of things. We have now passed the period of internal conflict in the launching of our program of social reform. Our full energies may now be released to invigorate the processes of recovery in order to preserve our reforms and to give every man and woman who wants to work a real job at a living wage. time. Time is of paramount importance. The deadline of danger from within and from without is not within our control. The hourglass may be in the hands of other nations. Our own hourglass tells us that we are off on a race to make democracy work so that we may be efficient in peace and therefore secure in national defense. This time element forces us to still greater efforts to attain the full employment of our labor and our capital. The first duty of our statesmanship is to bring capital and manpower together. Dictatorships do this by main force. By using main force, they apparently succeed at it for the moment. However, we abhor their methods. We are compelled to admit that they have obtained substantial utilization of all their material and human resources. Like it or not, they have solved, for a time at least, the problem of idle men and idle capital. Can we compete with them by boldly seeking methods of putting idle men and idle capital together and at the same time remain within our American way of life, within the Bill of Rights, and within the bounds of what is, from our point of view, civilization itself? We suffer from a great unemployment of capital. Many people have the idea that as a nation we are overburdened with debt and are spending more than we can afford. That is not so. Despite our federal government expenditures, the entire debt of our national economic system, public and private together, is no larger today than it was in 1929, and the interest thereon is far less than it was in 1929. And so the object is to put capital, private as well as public, to work. We want to get enough capital and labor at work to give us a total turnover of business, a total national income of at least $80 billion a year. At that figure, we shall have a substantial reduction of unemployment, and the federal revenues will be sufficient to balance the current level of cash expenditures on the basis of the existing tax structure. That figure can be attained working within the framework of our traditional profit system. The factors in attaining and maintaining that amount of national income are, it is true, many and complicated. They include more widespread understanding among businessmen of many changes which world conditions and technological improvements have brought to our economy over the last 20 years. Changes in the interrelationship of price and volume and employment, for example. Changes of the kind in which businessmen are now educating themselves through excellent opportunities like the so-called monopoly investigation. They include a perfecting of our farm program to protect farmers' income and consumers' purchasing power from alternate risks of crop gluts and crop shortages. They include wholehearted acceptance of new standards of honesty in our financial markets. They include reconcilement of enormous antagonistic interests, some of them long in litigation, in the railroad and the general transportation field. They include the working out of new technique, private, state and federal, to protect the public interest in and to develop wider markets for electric power. They include a revamping of the tax relationships between federal and state and local units of government, and consideration of relatively small tax increases to adjust inequalities without interfering with the aggregate income of the American people. They include the perfecting of labor organization and a universal ungrudging attitude by employers toward the labor movement until there is a minimum of interruption of production and employment because of disputes, and acceptance by labor of the truth that the welfare of labor itself depends on increased balanced output of goods. To be immediately practical, while proceeding with a steady evolution in the solving of these and like problems, we must wisely use instrumentalities like federal investment, which are immediately available to us. And here, as elsewhere, time is the deciding factor in our choice of remedies. Therefore, it does not seem logical to me, at the moment we seek to increase production and consumption, for the federal government to consider a drastic curtailment of its own investments. The whole subject of government investing and government income is one which may be approached in two different ways. The first calls for the elimination of enough activities of government to bring the expenses of government immediately into balance with income of government. This school maintains that because our national income this year is only $60 billion, ours is only a $60 billion country. And that government must treat it as such. And that without the help of government, it may someday, somehow, happen to become an $80 billion country. And an important point. If the Congress decides to accept this point of view, it will logically have to reduce the present functions or activities of government by one-third. Not only will the Congress have to accept the responsibility for such reduction, but the Congress will have to determine which activities are to be reduced. Certain expenditures, I believe we cannot possibly reduce at this session, such as the interest on the public debt. A few million dollars saved here or there in the normal or in curtailed work of the old departments and commissions will make no great saving in the federal budget. Therefore, the Congress would have to reduce drastically some of certain large items, very large items, such as aids to agriculture and soil conservation, veterans' pensions, flood control, highway aid, waterways, and other public works, grants for social and health security, Civilian Conservation Corps activities, relief for the unemployed, or national defense itself. The Congress alone has the power to do all this, as it is the appropriating branch of the government. The other approach to the question of government spending takes the position that this nation ought not to be and need not be only a $60 billion nation. That at this moment, it has the men and the resources sufficient to make it at least an $80 billion nation. This school of thought does not believe that it can become an $80 billion nation in the near future if government cuts its operations by one-third. It is convinced that if we were to try it, we would invite disaster, and that we would not long remain even a $60 billion nation. There are many complicated factors with which we have to deal, but we have learned that it is unsafe to make abrupt reductions at any time in our net expenditure program. By our common sense, action of resuming government activities last spring, we have reversed a recession and started the new rising tide of prosperity and national income, which we are now just beginning to enjoy. If government activities are fully maintained, there is definitely good prospect of our becoming an $80 billion country in a very short time. With such a national income, present tax laws will yield enough each year to balance each year's expenses. It is my conviction that down in their hearts, the American public, industry, agriculture, finance, wants this Congress to do whatever needs to be done to raise our national income to $80 billion a year. Investing soundly must preclude spending wastefully. To guard against opportunist appropriations, I have on several occasions addressed the Congress on the importance of permanent long-range planning. I hope, therefore, that following my recommendation of last year, a permanent agency will be set up and authorized to report on the urgency and on the desirability of the various types of government investment. Yes, investment for prosperity can be made in a democracy. I hear some people say, this is all so complicated. There are certain advantages in a dictatorship. It gets rid of labor trouble. It gets rid of unemployment, of wasted motion, and of having to do your own thinking. My answer is yes, but it also gets rid of some other things which we Americans intend very definitely to keep, and we still intend to do our own thinking. will cost us taxes and the voluntary risk of capital to attain some of the practical advantages which other forms of government have acquired. Dictatorship, however, involves costs which the American people will never pay. The cost of our spiritual value, the cost of the blessed right of being able to say what we please, the cost of freedom of religion, the cost of seeing our capital confiscated, the cost of being cast into a concentration camp, the cost of being afraid to walk down the street with the wrong neighbor, the cost of having our children brought up not as free and dignified human beings, but as pawns molded and enslaved by a machine. If the avoidance of these costs means taxes on my income, if avoiding these costs means taxes on my estate at death, I would bear those taxes willingly as the price of my breathing and my children breathing. The free air of a free country is the price of a living and not a dead world. Events across the seas have made it increasingly clear to the American people that dangers within are less to be feared than dangers from without. If, therefore, a solution of this problem of idle men and idle capital is the price of preserving our liberty, no formless, selfish fears can stand in the way. Once I prophesied that this generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. That prophecy comes true. To us, much is given. More is expected. This generation will nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just. A way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud and God must forever bless.
President, on the arm of Senator Watson, the military aide, shaking hands with Captain Banger, with Speaker Bankhead, and with Vice President Garner, is about to move down from the rostrum of the House of Representatives. Naturally, every member of this assembly chair is still on his feet, many of them clapping vigorously. The President steps down, bows, and smiles happily, and the crowd goes wild. Now going out of the door, out into the corridor. Now once again we turn our attention to the floor of the House, awaiting a word from Speaker Bankhead. The cabinet of the President of the United States is now stepping out. They shake hands rather cordially with members of the Senate who are on the right-hand exit beside the rostrum. The remainder of the assemblage, of course, is still standing as the cabinet leaves. watching as a great deal more handshaking than took place before takes place now after the president and the members of the cabinet have left. Now coming into the balcony beside me is Fulton Lewis, Jr., Mutual's regular Washington commentator, who is heard every evening on the Coast to Coast Mutual Network, Mondays through Fridays at 7 o'clock p.m., commenting from Washington on news of national note. And following a precedent we established last year, Mr. Lewis, the only network commentator on any national radio chain, will analyze the president's speech for you right now, directly from the scene of the address. I present Fulton Lewis, Jr.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. There's some very surprised faces down on the floor of the House of Representatives at the present time as a result of this speech that you've just heard from the President of the United States, his opening message to the 76th Congress. In one sense, this opening message represents one of the most astonishing and unexpected terms of President Roosevelt's political career. Ever since the November elections, there's been one great subject of conjecture here in the political world: what tack the president will take in this new session of Congress so far as policy is concerned. There were two possibilities. First, that the president might continue as he has for the last 6 years, exerting a rather strong hand over Congress to force through experimental legislation. In other words, to ignore the apparent swing of public sentiment as it showed up on November 8th. In that event, it very clearly meant a long and hectic session of Congress with bitter fighting and even more serious revolt within the Democratic Party than existed at the last session. The alternative possibility was that he might regard the November elections as a warning signal. He might abandon the idea of any further experiments in legislation. Let the Democratic Party spend the next 2 years in consolidating its position and perfecting the legislation that already is on the books. That, of course, is what the more conservative Democrats have been crying for. It's been generally conceded if that the president decided to shift his compass and sail this second course, the danger of any further splits among the Democrats would be greatly reduced, almost eliminated. The party would have 2 years to heal the wounds, and business would have at least 2 years to recover from the attack of jitters it claims to have gotten in the last six. So there were the two alternatives, one to continue on the old course and ignore the elections of last November, the other to concede that there was meaning in those elections and to shift to a more conciliatory and conservative course. And although the betting odds in general have been on the former course, in favor of the president taking the former course, it was the latter one that the president has taken in his speech today. If you listen to his address carefully, you'll recall that for the first time in recent years, this opening message contained no word, not even the slightest suggestion of attack or slur on business, industry, or even on general wealth as such. Going back 2 years, you may recall that the president said, after the 1936 elections, that in his first administration, he had proven himself the equal of business and industrial leaders and Wall Street operators. In his next 4 years, he said at that time, he proposed to prove himself their master. Today, there was not the slightest suggestion of that philosophy in word or tone of voice. The policy of attack on wealth is missing. The old theory of blind spending on the excuse of humanitarian purpose is completely gone. So is the theory of increasing government regulation of business and industry. On the contrary, the president says today that business and industry and private enterprise are the backbone of national existence. He bases his whole future program on an attempt to build them up, to help them get back on their feet. He takes a position by so doing, by raising the national income to $80 billion a year, above its present figure of $60 billion, there'll be more income to tax and therefore more revenue for the federal government. At the same time, unemployment will be absorbed into private jobs to produce that $80 billion income, and that will reduce the drain on the federal treasury for WPA, for pump priming operations, and for all sorts of relief and unemployment insurance. Now, so far as new legislation is concerned, the president flatly stated in this opening address today that he wants only two items: a program to help the railroads get back on their feet, which certainly will find no opposition in Congress or in the business or industrial world. As a matter of fact, that in itself is an important item in the general rehabilitation of the business world, because the present financial condition of the railroads is heavily depressing to the entire economic system. The other legislation that he wants is some form of government reorganization of the federal government. In both those cases, he merely makes the general suggestion. Unlike the past, he does not attempt to dictate specifically what the new reorganization bill shall be or how it shall be accomplished. He merely asks for a more efficient government machine with which to work. And even that point is almost certain to strike a sympathetic chord with the country as a whole. It's generally admitted that the present setup of the federal government certainly needs reorganization. The great objections to the reorganization bill in the last session, of course, were in the details and the methods. And this time, the president leaves all that up to Congress. Now, the president made one statement that caused something of a flurry among the Republicans in the chamber, the statement that the entire debt of our national economic structure, public and private together, is no larger than it was in 1929. That may have sounded to the casual listener as though he referred to the debt of the federal government. Actually, of course, he referred, as he said, to the combined private and public debt. As a matter of fact, the federal debt, of course, has been greatly increased since 1929, almost doubled. The reason the total debt has not increased is that the private debt has been greatly reduced on the books, and a large part of that reduction, of course, is due to the washing out of debts by bankruptcy proceedings and general liquidation during the Depression. That point is a mere detail. It may draw criticism from the Republican ranks, but it is not essential in the greater and more important broad sense of this message. Now, there's just one other outstanding point to this opening message today, the question of government spending. The president told Congress that he does not consider it wise at the present time to make any drastic reduction in government expenditures, investments, as he called them. To quote his exact words, he said, according to my copy, "It does not seem logical to me at the moment. We seek to increase production and consumption for the federal government to consider a drastic curtailment of its own investments." He argued that any reduction at the present time is likely to result in a setback to the general buildup of business and industry. His theory is to continue that buildup on the expectation that increased tax returns will creep up to meet the expenditures of government in the future, and that after business and industry are thoroughly rehabilitated, they themselves will take up the slack of unemployment and thereby automatically cut down the need for government spending. And even on that point, most of the conservatives are inclined to agree. Almost all of them recognize that a sudden and very abrupt elimination of all government spending would be a bad blow to business, industry in general, and to the whole economic cycle. But even on that point, the president accepted the criticism of his opponents today. You may recall that he insisted that the government expenditures must, however, be sound. They must avoid wasteful spending. The program, of course, is to do the spending on national defense. He explained that in the early part of his message, and he laid a careful groundwork for that national defense program by his discussion of the foreign situation, the need for protecting ourselves and making ourselves respected by other nations in a day of swifter, new weapons of attack. And so this message today has rather taken the conservative bloc of Congress by surprise. It has met and accepted virtually every criticism that the conservatives have had to make of the administration in the last 2 years. It steers carefully clear of telling Congress what to do or how to do it so that the president cannot be accused of dictating to another branch of the government. It admits that a great many faults exist in the legislation that the New Deal already has put through, and it recommends that this next session devote its time to perfecting those laws that are now on the book. It avoids any possible attack or slur on business or industry or wealth. It says that spending should continue, relief and pump priming only as a means of stimulating private business and industry so that business and industry itself can absorb unemployment and end the need for spending. The president said that spending should be done on worthwhile permanent improvements. He said that class warfare and bickering between labor and capital should be ended. He decreed a real breathing spell for the whole economic system, a rest from new experiments, from uncertainty and uneasiness. He admits perfectly frankly that many faults exist in the legislation that has been passed, and he suggests that Congress correct those faults. In short, the president accepted and attempted to meet virtually every criticism that the conservatives have made against the New Deal. It dumps Mr. Tommy Corcoran and Mr. Ben Cohen and the other extremists of the left completely overboard. But at the same time, very carefully, the president refuses to pick up the old guarders, the reactionaries on the extreme right. In fact, the president plumps himself down in the very middle of the road in this message today, and he digs in. Now, it's impossible, of course, to get any comment as yet from the members of Congress on this speech, but obviously that comment will take two forms. The president's enemies will charge him with being an opportunist. They say this speech today is a retreat as a result of the New Deal defeat in November. They'll say that he's willing to be generous now that he has most of his New Deal program on the books. The president's friends will say that he merely has been broad-minded and wise enough to recognize the desire and wishes of the American people as expressed at the polls last November. They say that that is the duty of the president. And as the legislation that's already on the books, they'll point to the fact that Mr. Roosevelt himself suggests that the legislation needs correction and revision. That's the way of politics. At any rate, business and industry ought to be pretty well pleased. As a general rule, the corner grocer doesn't care a great deal about the labels Republican or Democrat or New Deal or anti-New Deal. What he does care about is the sort of policies that those labels are tied to. And if the president really sticks to this course he took in his opening message today, it's just about what the corner grocer has been praying for. And now, ladies and gentlemen, until this evening, here's Mr. Walter Compton again, and good afternoon.
Fulton, thank you so much for coming up. I feel certain that all of our listeners enjoyed once again your intimate analysis and comment on the address of the President of the United States, which was delivered here this afternoon to the assembled houses of Congress at this opening session of the 76th Congress of the United States of America. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I still get a thrill out of being in a place of this kind. Every year when Congress convenes, I get a tremendous kick out of it. But now things are pretty well deadened off. Most of the members of the House and of the Senate have left, and there's just a few trickles of people still standing around here and there in groups. Last year, if you recall, we had two sessions of Congress. This year, there will be only one, but how long it will last, no one will know. Fulton, could you estimate, would you dare estimate how long?
I should say that this session will last 4 to 5 months, possibly into June.
Into June.
Into June.
But when it gets too hot, everybody goes home.
That's right. They don't go off as much now, Walter, as they used to, because we have air cooling.
Naturally, I might like to tell you also that Mr. Lewis worked under a great deal of difficulties here today, as all of us have, because our seats have been right in the aisle, right in the center of this chamber balcony, and people have been stepping on us from every direction in an effort to get out as soon as the president and his party and the cabinet members and the Senate had left. They were all anxious to get home, I suppose, and get a bite to eat. Of course, next year again, we'll have the same opening session, and Mutual will once again bring you an intimate picture of the United States Congress in action on its opening days. As I told you, I'd like to remind you that this is the only national network that has its microphones, its equipment, and its commentators actually within the chamber itself. This broadcast comes to you through the facilities of the Civic Features Division of Station WOL. This is Walter Compton speaking from Washington, and this is the Coast to Coast Network of the Mutual Broadcasting System.
To thank the makers of Post's 40%.
And so the doorkeeper announced the President of the United States, and now the President is filing into the House chamber itself, and Vice President Garner and Speaker Bankhead are looking toward him and listening to him. Of course, he is preceded as usual by members of the United States Secret Service. It's on the arm of his military aide, General Watson, followed by Captain Callahan, his naval aide, and Tom Quarters, his immediate bodyguard. Vice President Garner stands there with a smile on his face, looking at the president. The president is smiling back. The galleries are full, not to overflowing, because this was on ticket admission, and some of the seats have not been taken. In the presidential box, we can see Mrs. Roosevelt and Mitzi Lahan, and you can hear now the ovation for the president. Galleries are standing, of course, as are the members of the House of Representatives, Senate, and the Cabinet. And in a rear row, we can see seven members of the United States Supreme Court. And now the President stands at his Speaker's table. And in a moment, when this ovation has subsided, I think perhaps Mr. Roosevelt, or rather President Roosevelt, will begin his address. The galleries are particularly loud, will not stop. Speaker Bankhead has hit the gavel once or twice and is now speaking to his parliamentarian. And now, Speaker Bankhead.